Midlands today with Tullamore Motors Opel, where the Mach-E is in stock and available for immediate delivery. Start your electric driving journey today at tullamoremotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Well, good morning. How's your Thursday going so far? Have you been stressed out yet? Because a new piece of research says your first disaster of the day should have happened about an hour ago, 8:18, to be precise. I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. Also coming up today, the Carmelite priest, once a GAA hero in Westmeath, now the centre of abuse allegations. The exercises that will keep you strong and stable in later life. And your help is needed to find an engagement ring in Athlone. You can only imagine the stress involved in this situation. When you call, 0818 300 103 is my number. You can text or you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. Very dramatic scenes in Wexford captured on the front pages today, where the largest evacuation in the history of the Irish Health Service has taken place. More than 200 patients transferred to different hospitals last night after a fire at Wexford General. And it was evacuated after a major emergency was declared. The top story on the Irish Times. AIB agreed 1,900 big debt write-off deals after the crash. So DJ Carey has brought all of this under the microscope, and his deal angered quite a few, both in real life and in politics, where it was reported that 99% of his debt had been written off. Now, for accuracy, according to the Times, Mr. Carey had a judgment for €9.5 million made against him in 2011. But some properties were sold at Mount Juliet in Kilkenny and at the K Club in Kildare. So that reduced his debt by €1.8 million. So there was €7.7 million outstanding, and, well, all of that was written down to about €60,000. And there are other cases like his amounting to 1,900 borrowers who've had that level of write-down. So why hasn't it been applied to everybody who got into some form of debt problem? That's obviously going to be the question. Moral hazard was talked about a lot a decade ago. It seems it applied to some and not to others. Front of the Irish Independent today, again another picture of the smoking embers from Wexford General Hospital. It was the hospital's plant room where the fire broke out, and you see the fire service keeping it under control. A wave of white smoke washing across the picture. Thankfully, nobody injured in this event. A woman who had given birth by caesarean section less than 24 hours earlier described how she was moved down a smoke-filled corridor with her newborn child. So while there may be no physical damage, I'm sure the emotional scar of trauma like that will last a long time. Top story, though, on the Irish Independent. Energy companies face new levy on above-normal profits. So ESB, because it's one of the biggest generators of electricity in the country, is going to have to pay a special dividend to the taxpayer because of all the extra money it is making. And that brings us on to some of the pensioners who are paying over and above the odds. Highlighted in several newspapers today, one, Jerry Clark, who is 77 and lives in Robinstown near Navan with his son and his daughter-in-law. He said, this time last year, his electricity bill was €290. Keep that in your head, €290. This week, he received a bill for £1,678 for the 9th of December to the 10th of February. And he says he uses oil to heat his home. The electricity is used mainly for lighting, appliances and a water pump. And he hasn't changed his usage in the last 15 years, and his bills have been consistent until now. And then in the Irish Times, you meet Kitty from County Meath as well. She is 100 years young and has been totally gobsmacked after getting an electricity bill for €957, covering again a two-year period. And this is highlighted by Sinn Féin TD Johnny Girk, who says, the last time she received a bill, the previous high was €430. Now it's nearly 1,000. And would have been 1,200, by the way, because there were various deductions and credits. The gross bill was 1,200. It was reduced to 957. And this woman has a pension, and it's her only income, of about €200 per week. Now, elsewhere in the Irish Times, the story of Father Michael Cremen, who people will know in Moat and beyond, mainly for his GAA record. He led the Carmelite team to no less than 3 All-Ireland school football titles in 1976, 1980 and in 1981. They claimed 6 Leinster medals during that period. He was also involved in Westmeath GAA, managing the minor team in the early 60s, and he coached the senior football team in the early 80s. He was very much steeped in GAA and received the GAA's President's Award in 2009 for his contribution to football. Father Cremen died in 2019. But people are coming forward now with allegations of abuse. For instance, one boy says in the 1970s, when he was 14 years of age, he was called to the priest's room among 2 or 3 other students, and Father Cremen would always find a way to send the others off, and then the abuse would take place. Others have suggested it happened in plain sight, in the classroom. More details on this after the news at 10 today. But is it something that, number one, you believe? Is it something that was rumoured at the time? Because the challenge now is investigating this obviously misses a key witness. The man is dead, so he's not there to defend himself. But that's not to in any way discredit what others are saying. It's just, if they are correct, there will be no justice, because the man is not around to serve his sentence, to appear in court. So how do they get closure again if this is true? Holly Cairns is highlighted in many papers today. She is the new leader of the Social Democrats and the youngest party leader in the Dáil, and actually called out one of the main concerns that her critics have expressed. How on earth did she get here? As somebody who has been only in the Dáil for a few weeks, how is she now a party leader? And she says, some say I am too inexperienced for the job, and to them I say I have plenty of experience. I grew up on a small dairy farm in West Cork. I worked as a waitress through school and through college, and I had to emigrate after the crash. So I may not fit the stereotype of a politician, but that is not a bad thing. And let's not forget that some of the most experienced politicians in the country bankrupted it less than a decade ago. And some of them, by the way, are still in power today, she says. And her plan is to represent a lost generation, those who are unable to get on the housing ladder, those who will be the first generation to be worse off than their parents. That's what she told the Dáil in her first official day as leader of the Social Democrats. To the sillier side of the news, Peltz Beckham. Are you familiar with Brooklyn and his wife, Nicola Peltz Beckham? Apparently she didn't enjoy the wedding a year ago, even though they spent €3.5 million on the event. And they now want to stage a second wedding, one that will be positive, happy, and will be devoid of the stress she encountered the first time around, apparently having to deal with the wedding planners absolutely stressed her out. And there's also the niggling rumour that maybe she had some interfering in-laws to deal with as well. But the Irish Independent, Tanya Sweeney, writes how they've really missed the whole point of marriage, which is to commit yourself to somebody else, to exchange your vows and then to live, well, happily ever after, hopefully. Doesn't always happen. But to have a second wedding a year later just because the first one worked out not as you intended, that's really having more money than sense, isn't it? And one more on the weather, because we've had a little bit of a cold snap in the last week and it's going to continue. In fact, it might even deepen. Met Air and climatologist Paul Moore tells the Irish Independent that there will be next week a chance of temperatures down to minus zero and a mixing with some precipitation, in other words, sleet and snow, by the end of next week. He is more optimistic for the summer, though. He talks about the El Nino weather phenomenon coming to Ireland, so we might have a spike in temperatures in the second half of this year. Fingers crossed, that'd be very nice indeed. Now, to that piece of research which says you should have been stressed out at 7:23 a.m. That is the most stressful time of the day. Are you even awake? I'm hitting the snooze button for, I think, the second time around then. And the first daily drama is at 8:18 a.m. So they surveyed 2,000 people to figure out when they would have their spikes in stress through the day. The average person has three dramas in 24 hours. Women say their first is at 10 to 8. Men don't have a drama until 8:43. I'm on the list of dramas. Clothing. Something spilling on your clothes. Yes, always coffee. And always on the crotch. It never goes anywhere else. Burning food or tripping over in public. Yes, because we're all the same. We all get up at the same time. We all work with the same people and we all have the same challenges. Not. Nearly every section of society is impacted in some way by the housing shortage. And of course, most acutely are those you hear the Midland Simon community represent. But let's look at this from a business perspective for a moment. If you are at the helm of a growing company and you wish to attract the best and brightest to the Midlands, where can they live? And to quote Simon McKeever, who represents the Irish Exporters Association, he says, if people cannot get homes or afford them, then how are employers going to be able to attract new workers and hold on to the ones they have? It is something that is now absolutely critical and business is screaming about it. He was appearing before an Oireachtas committee along with a number of other representatives of business to outline their concerns. And listening among the TDs was Joe Flaherty, Fianna Fáil representative in Longford, West Meath. Deputy Flaherty, good morning. From the range of contributions you listened to, which one struck you the hardest?
Well, I suppose the media has zoned in on the point of companies providing houses for staff. Here in the Midlands, it's not that unusual a concept. Many of the listeners here this morning will remember that was a raison d'etre with Bordnamona when they brought literally thousands of workers to the Midlands and built housing estates right across the Midlands. So concept-wise, it's not that unusual. And it's been ongoing, perhaps not obviously at the scale of Bordnamona. I think the reference yesterday was that companies are looking at buying in entire estates. We will be familiar with companies that are leasing houses, are buying houses for staff. And I know even a lot of small businesses have taken to it. A number of nursing home operators that I've been dealing with over the last couple of months tell me that they've had to buy houses themselves so that they can have accommodation for staff when they come to work here in Ireland. So the reality is we have a housing crisis. There's no quick fix to it. I think it's fair to say the government has thrown absolutely everything at it. And, you know, anything and everything that helps us to get to grips with the housing crisis has to be welcomed. And obviously, the other aspect to this as well is it's increasingly hard to actually source staff at the moment. And it's a very, very competitive market out there, and particularly in the whole area of pharma, healthcare, electronics and IT, it's particularly hard to attract staff, and in many instances a lucrative package, you know, a good salary might also include accommodation.
The quandary here is that you've competing forces. So while companies have the buying power to secure these houses, it means there's somebody individually, perhaps to the pin of their collar, facing an uplift in rent or that first rung on the property ladder if they're going for a mortgage, that price, that asking price has now inflated.
Point, and and it's very true in that, you know, we've seen an exponential rise in rents locally. We also have the issue where there's a large number of whether we call them accidental landlords or people that bought properties at the wrong time and had to hold on to them until they valued them, came back and are now selling them to try and get their money back. So it's a perfect storm in the housing market at the minute. But you're quite right in saying that the people to the pin of their collars are suffering. It's very hard to compete with a multinational. If a multinational decides it wants to rent a house that's possibly advertised on Daft for €1,200 a month, it's not inconceivable they can easily go to €1,500 a month for that house, and you're out of luck then.
There's another aspect of the multinationals being here in that they're able to provide remote working opportunities and other soft benefits apart from cash, which perhaps some of the smaller Indigenous businesses can't cope with or compete with. And that's a point that was made by the Chambers Ireland Chief Executive Ian Talbot yesterday. So strategically, and you're a policymaker, how do you respond to that concern?
Yeah, and that is a fair point. And the remote working bill is going through the Enterprise Committee at the minute. And you know, that's a point that IBEC have made. And there's a lot of small businesses that really can't provide, you know, the workers' expectations of remote working. And remote working has transformed the landscape in Ireland, particularly as a result of COVID. You know, they say now in Dublin that Thursday is the new Friday night because most offices are bereft of people in Dublin on a Friday. So in terms of the whole working week, there's been a huge change, and similarly Monday is very quiet. So that's having a knock-on effect then for restaurants and bars in Dublin on Monday and Friday, and it's effectively reduced their week as well in terms of potential income as well. So I think, you know, the remote working bill, there's a lot of work to be done on that at committee stage. We have to look at it in the context of how it's affecting the whole of Ireland, but very much so the point you make that we do need to make sure that it doesn't penalise and put further pressures on small businesses who are already in many instances are coping with a higher minimum wage, which is very important, and a whole raft of additional measures and responsibilities.
But equally, if a company can secure a workforce anywhere in Ireland through remote working model, they could, in theory, look abroad to cheaper labour markets as well, couldn't they?
That's always the way, but I think, you know, Ireland's biggest selling point is the quality of our staff. You know, we've an exceptional workforce here in Ireland. People always like to find fault with the country, but we're one of the most modern, progressive and fastest growing economies and democracies in Europe. We're only 100 years old as a country. It was thanks to the strong performance of one of the smallest countries in Europe, i.e. Ireland, that we managed to keep Europe out of a recessionary situation last year. So we should never underestimate or never undersell ourselves. We can compete with any country in the world when it comes to trying to attract jobs to Ireland, purely on one point, and that is the absolute expertise, ability and know-how of our staff. And then we have other aspects such as the quality of life here, the high standard of education. All of these are huge pluses, but obviously a potential drawback is the housing situation at the minute. And as I says, everything humanly possible has been done by this government to try and address housing. And you know, the minister himself, he won't knock back any option or any potential solution. He'll look at everything and anything. There's been probably an unprecedented raft of measures launched by the Department of Housing over the last 2.5 years in a desperate effort to try and resolve housing. It's a constant work in progress. No stone will be left unturned. And I know that the Minister and indeed everybody in this government are determined that we resolve the housing situation in Ireland.
But when you hear those stark warnings from various representatives yesterday and add into it all the social pressures that people are feeling to secure housing, are you just shrugging your shoulders and saying, we're doing the best we can,
no,
we can do no more?
Certainly not shrugging my shoulders, because every elected representative in this country is living with the housing crisis on a daily basis. I'm here in my office today in Longford, and the overwhelming theme of every person that will come in this door today is housing, whether they've got a notice to quit, whether they've got a rent increase, or whether they simply have no accommodation at all. It is the biggest single crisis, and we're dealing with it on a daily basis, and we're certainly not shrugging our shoulders about it, and we're determined to resolve it. But aside from the pressures and the amount of people, the vast growth in our population, the the struggle that it is to get staff and to get builders to build these houses. The point that's often lost in this is the quality of houses that we're building now that is putting additional pressures in terms of time to build those houses, but also on cost to build those houses. So we've made a lot of mistakes in the past. We've had the mica crisis, which is trying to be addressed through a redress scheme. We've also the apartments defects. So houses that we built 10, 15 years ago were clearly inferior to the houses that we're building now. And I spoke to a builder's representative a number of weeks ago, and I asked him, in terms of a standard three-bedroom house that you would have built in the Midlands perhaps 15 years ago, and pro rata, if you looked at the pricing then and now, how much extra and is that costing you to build now? And also, how much longer is it costing you? Is it taken to build? He says anything in the order of 60,000 to 80,000 extra as a result of the new and welcome specifications in those houses, and taking anything to 4 to 5 months extra to build those houses. So there's an awful lot of additional factors as well, but by no means are we shrugging our shoulders on this. Will, we know this is the biggest single crisis. We said this.
Okay, despite those efforts, there appears to be some sort of a slowdown. So 30,000 units, give or take, were built in 2022. The number of commencements in the second half of the year were down 13% on the 2021 figure, and the number of planning permissions granted nationally in the third quarter of last year down 41%. What's going wrong?
There's probably an element of hesitancy on the part of builders. Builders build based on a commercial decision, and we've had huge inflationary pressures. We've had a war in Ukraine to put huge pressure on the sourcing of materials. So, you know, much like the actual supply, the actual construction as well is in a perfect storm situation. You know, we're dealing, this is the first war that we've had in Europe in 80 years. It's putting huge pressure on the construction sector. Price increases in the order of 20 to 30% on materials. If you're a builder and you're looking at building a scheme of 20 to 30 houses, your finance is precarious from banks. They're hesitant at the moment. There's an awful lot of factors. It's not quite as simple as a builder rocking up with a lorry load of concrete and starting to
What relief do you give them? Because at the same time, we've hotels booming in Dublin and they continue to enjoy a 9% VAT rate. So do you consider a special VAT rate in construction, for instance?
It has been muted, and construction sector certainly looked for a VAT rate. But we can't keep putting sticky plasters on the situation. You know, we also have to accept that probably there was an element of those price increases that might have been mercenary and might have been opportunistic. And there comes a time when the state really has to say, we can't fix everything. We cannot throw money at everything. At the end of the day, it has to be, you know, a collective responsibility, and we have to address it. And that's why there's a multitude of efforts trying to address the housing crisis at the minute. And you have to bear in mind that this isn't just an Irish housing crisis. It's a housing crisis right across Europe. We've had the biggest mass exodus of people in Europe that we've had since the Second World War, and Europe as a continent is struggling to deal with that at the minute. So this isn't an isolated problem just in Ireland. There's a housing crisis right across Europe at the minute. But I would say that probably no country is as fixated or as determined in its efforts to resolve this housing crisis as is Ireland.
Joe Flaherty, Fianna Fáil TD for Longford Westmeath. Thank you for taking the call. 083 30 10 103. Text and WhatsApp your opinion. And indeed, if there is a solution that hasn't been mentioned, if there is an obvious silver bullet and perhaps a stone that has been left unturned. Suffice to say, a lot of people derisory of the Beckhams, the Peltz Beckhams, considering a second wedding a year after their first one didn't quite live up to their lofty expectations. Here in the real world, imagine losing an engagement ring. Because it is a one in a lifetime. Well, hopefully a one in a lifetime. Some people get engaged several times. This lady needs your help, and she has been very distressed in recent days. And with luck and with a little effort in the Athlone area, maybe we can put her out of her misery. Regarding the massive write-down for DJ Carey, and AIB confirming that he's certainly far from the only person, a four-figure number of people being given write-downs of 90% or more. Well, one person asks, how can they borrow so much in the first place? Well, it very much, I suppose, depends on the assets you have backing it. If you're in business and you're putting the business there as personal security, But it does seem like an insane amount of money coming down on one individual. And you have to remember, in the Celtic Tiger, that wasn't uncommon. There was a corner shop owner in, I think it was Monaghan, who was offered €10 million to develop a shopping centre. Actually, I think it was 18, now that I think closer about it, €18 million to develop a shopping centre, and their only security was a corner shop. That's the sort of lending that happened in the boom, and many earned bonuses on the back of that. They were encouraged to be reckless, in effect. Have times changed? That's the big question. Anyway, more on that a little bit later. And as for Joe Flaherty asserting that Ukraine is the first war in Europe in 80 years, Hilda asks, shall we conclude that Yugoslavia is not in Europe? And as for everything humanly possible being done to provide houses, except, of course, building houses, she says. Now, let's see, can we help with a very, very upsetting and distressing situation? Unlike the Pelts Beckhams, who want to get married all over again, for most of us, it's a one-time deal, and a one-time deal getting an engagement ring, and you want to hold it and treasure it and keep it forever. Niamh is on the phone from Galway. Good morning, Niamh.
Good morning, Will. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You were travelling through the Midlands last Saturday. Tell us what happened.
Yes, I was driving from Galway to Dublin to meet up with some friends for a gathering, birthday celebration, and I stopped in Athlone in the Apple Green filling station in Arcadia Retail Park in Athlone. And anyway, when I got out of the car to fill my petrol, my engagement ring fell off my knee and onto the ground, and I didn't miss it until later on. The reason it was on my knee is because my finger was swollen that morning and I wasn't able to fit it on my finger. And I just said, oh, I'll put it on later, and left it sitting on my lap. But when I got out of the car to fill the petrol, I didn't think about it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And obviously you didn't hear it at the time. So how far had you travelled before you realised what happened?
I had got as far as Moat and realised that I missed it and turned back straight away. So I was back to the Apple Green within about half an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour. And the staff were very helpful there, I have to say. The filling station was extremely busy, I might tell you. So they looked at CCTV, we searched the forecourts, we looked everywhere, and there has been no sign of it then or since. And I called in on my way back down that evening from Dublin, and still no sign, and I've been in touch with them every day since, and I've also been on to the Garda station at Lone, just in the hope that maybe if somebody picked it up or found it, mightn't have realised it had much value, but it has a lot of value sentimentally and every other way to me. So I was just hoping that maybe if somebody did come across it that and didn't know what to do with it, maybe to hand it into the Garda station or the Apple Green in the Arcadia Retail Park in Athlone.
Can you describe it for us, Niamh?
It's a cluster. It's a ruby, an oval-shaped ruby surrounded by 8 diamonds. And it's, on a gold band. So, it's 35 years old, so it has a big sentimental value. And I can't wear it because of the work I do. So a lot of people say, why do you take it off at all? But anyway, the nature of the work I do, I work with children, and so I don't wear it during the week to work. But it just sometimes my fingers are swollen in the morning time and it's difficult to get on. And anyway, that's what happened.
I'm guessing you've searched the car just in case it went in a crevice between a seat or some obscure place.
You've no idea how many times I've pulled out every single mat, everything. I've gone with torches, with not a metal detector because there's so much metal on
it. Of course.
But I have gone through it. I have literally sifted through it several times since because, you kind of start to doubt yourself. But yes, I have searched everywhere in the car and
What would it mean to you to get this back?
Oh, well, it would mean a lot. I mean, I really would love to be able to get it back. It's not something I think I would ever replace because it won't be the same. It has a huge sentimental value. I suppose my husband is disappointed for me because he can see that how upset I am, and I suppose I'm not one to ring radio stations or contact people, but it's in desperation, it's just to try and maybe trigger if somebody spotted something or if they maybe picked it up or just if somebody maybe just saw it or spoke to somebody who saw it, that they they'd know what to do with it, that it's very sentimental, and I would really, really love to get it back because I'm not careless.
So, reiterating, last Saturday morning, it was about 11:30 when you were at the petrol pumps in Apple Green in the Arcadia Retail Park in Athlone. You even know that you were at petrol pump number one, just in case that rings a bell with anybody. And hopefully, fingers crossed, and saying a little prayer that it turns up and it is reunited with its rightful owner. Niamh, we're rooting for you.
Thank you so much, Will. I appreciate you and your researchers. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Not at all, Niamh. That's what we're here for. And hopefully we can give this story a happy ending with your help. Now, still to discuss today, Back to the Future. A decade after many Midlands Garda stations closed, some of them are about to reopen. Leash doctor Diane Cooper explains the exercises that will keep you stable and strong in later life. And do you need planning permission for a small extension? It depends. I bet that's the answer our rights expert gives from 11:20 today. Now, when you call 0818 300 103 is my number. You can text 3 30 10 103. That may bring back a lot of harrowing for some people who were abused earlier. Allegations at this stage, allegations being made about a former football coach who guided the Carmelites in Moat to no less than 3 All-Ireland titles and indeed was involved in Westmeath GAA for a time in the 70s and 80s. He was even recognised with a GAA President's Award in 2009. At the centre of these allegations, Father Michael Cremin, who passed away in 2019. Jack Power has the story in the Irish Times today. Jack, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
So tell us more about the allegations and who is making them.
Yeah, so we started investigating this story last year. I got a contact from a person who had alleged that they had been sexually abused in the Carmelite College in Moat by Father Michael Cremin. And so on foot of that, the Irish Times basically started devoting resources to basically finding out if this was true, you know, trying to contact and track down other alleged victims and survivors or people who'd witnessed stuff. And we published that story in today's paper. I have spoken to 3 men who alleged when they were boys in the Moat Carmelites boarding school that they were sexually abused by Michael Cremin. We also spoke to 3 past pupils who disclosed witnessing Cremin abuse other kind of classmates, at times kind of during the class in corridors and kind of spare classrooms. The alleged abuse is also claimed to have happened up in Michael Cremin's room in the school. And the allegations mainly range from the 1970s to the 1980s, when Cremin was a maths teacher in the school, and as you said, would have been a high-profile GAA coach. He was kind of known and kind of well known locally and around Westmeath through his kind of coaching success that he brought and the school team, and then as you said, the Westmeath minor team, and then I think he coached the men's senior team for a period in the 1980s.
Now, while some of this abuse is alleged to have happened discreetly and he would have had this room and indeed found ways to get some of the other students out of the room so individuals were one-to-one, others are suggesting he was more open about it in the classroom.
Yeah, there seemed to be a kind of a common modus operandi, you know, during classes, which several kind of former students and past pupils reported to me was kind of a regular occurrence where he would kind of squeeze in beside a boy who's sitting at a desk or lean over their desk and essentially grope and allegedly molest them kind of openly in class. And, you know, several men I spoke to kind of described now speaking with kind of incredulity looking back said that it was just this kind of open thing that happened in the class. You know, some of the men said, you know, the other boys would just kind of put their heads down and just hope it wasn't then that it was happening to effectively.
There was also an allegation, not necessarily sexual abuse, but of physical abuse. And this comes from a John Sheehan, who is a lecturer at University College Cork. He describes an incident with a sweeping brush.
Yeah, I spoke to him, and he effectively said that, you know, and I suppose a lot of listeners would, you know, would kind of be aware that physical abuse is much more common you know, back in periods like the 1970s. But John kind of recalled a particular incident that he described as kind of particularly brutal, where Michael Premin beat a boy with a sweeping brush and was very over the top. And that was something that that kind of a few other people that I spoke to described, you know, cases where Michael Premin was known to be kind of a tough character, either in terms of discipline on the GAA pitch or in the classroom.
Well, let's talk about that public persona, particularly with the GAA. How involved was he?
Yeah, so he would effectively have been known as the, you know, the GAA coach in the region. You know, he managed the Westmead minor football team, I think, in the early 60s, and then he managed the senior team in the early 80s for a period. And but he had his main, I suppose, bit of success would have been with the school team, which he guided to 3 Hogan Cup All-Ireland schools titles, and I think 6 Leinster titles during the same period. So this is really kind of the heyday of kind of the Carmelite school GAA team, which really would have been seen as a kind of a and well established as a GAA kind of nursery. Like, a lot of players would have then gone on to play and, you know, play you know, and have very successful careers in other kind of counties. So yeah, I think he won 3 All Ireland school titles in 1976, 1980, and 1981, and as I said, 6 Leinster titles during that period. And a lot of the past people I spoke to who alleged that they'd been abused or they'd witnessed Kremlin abusing other boys, they kind of said that coaching success kind of, I suppose, conferred an element of kind of celebrity upon him, both certainly in the school and in kind of the local community. I spoke to one man who wasn't quoted in the piece and didn't want to speak for the piece, but he said you'll find very difficult for, you know, people locally to say a bad word about Michael Kremlin, in part because of that kind of coaching success. So I think that potentially for a period, I would imagine, made it much more difficult for men to come forward about what had happened to them, because he was this kind of towering figure in kind of the local community because of that success. And then he only died in recent years, in 2019. And following that, one of the men that I spoke to reported the matter to the Carmelites and to the Gardaí. The Gardaí investigated it, but obviously as the accused is deceased, you know, they could take no action, obviously. But I do understand that the complaints were also reported to the Carmelites after his death. And the Carmelites issued a statement in response to the article where they said, you know, they couldn't comment publicly on deceased or living individuals who are subject to allegations of abuse. However, Michael Troy, Father Michael Troy, the provincial of the Carmelite Order, he did encourage anyone who had been abused in its schools or other settings to come forward to the order. And, you know, he made the point that they have since been trying to, you know, kind of provide support to people who are abused in their schools, which also includes Terenure College in Dublin, and that they have, in as far as possible, tried to, you know, settle any civil actions for compensation in a fair and expedient manner. You know, just one kind of quote from him, he said, you know, our repeated words of sincere apology can often seem repetitive, but it is important for victims and survivors to hear that we are deeply sorry for what happened to them. So that's a statement from the Carmelite Order who ran Moat College, which had closed in 1996, I think.
And Jack, what has the GAA to say in response to these allegations?
Yeah, so I obviously put the claims to both Westmead GAA and the GAA headquarters in Croke Park, and Westmead said that, you know, that they hadn't in their records any reports or disclosures of abuse had been reported to them, and the GAA nationally said similarly that they'd received no reports of abuse allegations or child protection concerns about Father Kremlin related to his coaching. But as Pete makes clear, you know, he was in, I think, 2009 awarded the GAA kind of President's Award. So it, you know, kind of remains to be seen whether that will now be revised in light of these allegations coming to light.
So for the alleged victims, the Garda investigation obviously it's exhausted the options available, given that the man is dead and there's no criminal sanction that can be applied even if he was found guilty. So are they considering a civil action?
Yeah, well, I suppose that would be, and as is the case with many of these instances of kind of historical sexual abuse, in a lot of cases the perpetrators are deceased by the time the survivor, the victim, you know, kind of really comes to terms with things, often potentially in the middle or later part of their life, and seeks to kind of get some redress or get some kind of justice or truth. And in cases of this one where the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, is deceased, I suppose one of the really only options open is to file a civil case against the Carmelite Order for compensation, and to sue them as a party in the High Court. And that's something that, you know, following allegations of sexual abuse in Black Rock College and other schools, like, there has been a significant number of kind of people coming forward to organisations like One in Four, the support group, and other kind of lawyers who would kind of specialise in taking, you know, child abuse cases and historical abuse cases, that they've reported to me that, you know, since I think last November, they've seen a significant increase in the amount of people who are abused in boarding schools coming forward to actually look at their options in terms of potentially taking a civil case. And that is one way that the organisation and the order can somewhat be held accountable in terms of paying out compensation in cases where the alleged perpetrator is deceased and, you know, there could be no action or criminal investigation there, obviously.
But the nature of these situations is they are sensitive, and this is reflected already in some of the comments we've received from listeners to your story today, that they remember Father Cremin rather fondly for his achievements in the GAA and elsewhere, and are wondering why these men are now making the allegations only after he died.
Yeah, I suppose it's not so much the men coming forward. It was more the Irish Times somewhat tracking them down. You know, it started with one individual who's alleged to have been abused by Father Cremin, and following that, I kind of set about looking to contact other people, past pupils, asking them if they've, you know, heard of cases where people have had, you know, kind of bad experiences. And often as well, like that initial individual only came forward to me on foot of an article we did related to historical abuse in Castleknock College, which itself only kind of, I suppose, came about following the revelations of abuse in kind of Blackrock College. So I think there's definitely a sense that a lot of this has kind of been left lie for decades. And following the revelations in November of past abuse in Blackrock College, and a lot of you know, up to hundreds of people coming forward on foot of that, with allegations of abuse in various different, you know, private kind of boarding schools, and often in very prestigious schools, that this is another one of those cases that, you know, kind of men spoke to me sometimes in cases where they hadn't told their families about what had happened to them as children. So it's as it is often with these things, it can kind of have a ripple effect when revelations appear in kind of a similar school, that only then other stuff kind of comes to light.
Well, you can read more in the Irish Times today. Jack Power, thank you for taking our call.
Thank you very much, Will.
Regarding Niamh's engagement ring, lost last Saturday, possibly in the Athlone area at the Apple Green in Arcadia Retail Park, Moll makes a good point. It could easily be stuck in somebody's tyre. That's a needle in a haystack if that has happened, Moll. But yes, somebody driving over the ring, it would probably penetrate its way into the rubber of the tyre. Will, this may be extreme, says Nuala, but she could ring all the pawn shops in Dublin, Galway, as well as locally or indeed elsewhere in the country. Somebody passing through to get fuel could have picked it up. And yes, indeed. Perhaps call other radio stations too. Spread the word far and wide. Pat in Tullamore says he would be doing a major search of the car. Get somebody with mechanical experience to search it again. There may be many hidden crevices and so on in the car's interior. Apple Green really examined the cameras. If they did so, well, then they would have seen somebody pick it up. But I wish her the best of luck, says Pat in Tullamore. And a landlord has been in touch in response to Joe Flaherty, the Fianna Fáil TD in Longford Westmeath. hearing about the housing crisis from businesses and how some companies are even buying up whole estates, the major multinationals who want to have accommodation for their staff. While on the other end of the landlord spectrum, Jim says, I receive €1,400 per month in rent, €600 of which goes to the government. I pay €1,000 per month on my mortgage, and I also have the upkeep of the property. So there's no money in renting in his case. So it's a complex situation. Next, the exercises that you should do now to ensure you are strong and stable in later life. Leash Dr. Diane Cooper, still on the agenda today. Your rights expert is here from 20 past 11. One of the questions, do you need planning permission for a small extension? What's your idea of a small extension? What's my idea of a small extension? That could well be one of the issues in answering that question. And also, back to the future. A decade after many Midlands Garth stations closed, some of them are about to reopen, which makes you wonder what was the point of the exercise in the first place. Speaking of exercise, different kind of exercise, a new study by University College Dublin suggests 20 minutes of daily activity can reverse frailty if you are over the age of 65. And it looks at 10 exercises which will strengthen your arms and your legs and thus improve your balance and your coordination. Now, if you're a listener to the Midlands 103 Health and Fitness Show, you'll know that Dr. Diane Cooper has quite a background in this area. Indeed, she's spoken on this programme about it before. Diane, good morning.
Good morning, Will. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. And bearing in mind you're talking to somebody who, you know, tries to put on a sock with one foot and falls over. And I'm in my 40s, so I've quite a lot of work to do here. Talk to us, first of all, about frailty and why we should avoid it if we can.
Yes. So, look, it's great to see these things coming out, being published and being spoken about as well. Frailty is a serious, serious issue. Now, but the thing of it is so basically what happens is if you're frail, you've lost an awful lot of muscle mass. You've lost an awful lot of strength. With that, you get a loss of bones. You have weak bones. Everything is really on the decline. Your metabolic health, your cardiovascular health, like the things that you can do in your day, everything's on a decline. And if you have frailty, you are much more likely to fall. And if you fall, you're much because of the muscle frailty and the bone frailty, you're much more likely to have fractures and breaks and hospitalizations and all sorts of stuff. So, like, hip fractures would be a big consequence of frailty. And of course, like, we associate frailty with aging. And the big message that I really want to say today is it's not inevitable. So it's not just because we age that we get frail. The real issue is that if we age and we're inactive, then absolutely we're on a fast track to frailty. But if we keep active and do particularly strengthening exercises, well, then frailty can largely be avoided, which is really important to know because it has such a detrimental effect on your health and your quality of life if you do end up being quite frail.
So what exercises will counteract the effects of that sedentary lifestyle and the aging process?
So, yeah, so really, if you're talking about, so frailty is it's a serious lack of strength and it's a serious lack of muscle. And if you need to increase the size of your muscles, now I don't mean to bodybuilding levels, I mean just to keep as well as we age, and you need to increase your strength, you're really looking at resistance training. So what do I mean by that? People think resistance training and they might think, oh, I need to go to the gym and I need to lift weights and I need to, you know, swing kettlebells and do these types of things. But it actually starts a lot more simple than that. It starts with using your own body weight and, you know, for example, sit to stand. So if you're sitting in, if you spend a lot of time of your day sitting in a chair, well then, go from the sitting position to the standing position and back down again. And you just repeat that. So we call that sit to stand. And effectively what you're doing is squats. So in your own kitchen, you can do your squats. You can do your lunges. You can do a few push-ups off your counter. You can do all of these things and they'll give you great benefits for strength. And you don't need hours and hours to do them. And I can see that in that study. Like they're talking about, you know, 20 minutes in the day because one of the barriers, the most common barrier, is I don't have time to train. And I understand that. I absolutely understand time constraints. But one of the things we would ask people to do is, you know, it's while the kettle boils challenge. So if you're like me and I'm working from home and you go down, you know, 3 or 4 times in the day to have a cup of coffee, while the kettle is boiling, if you can't do anything else in your day, pick an exercise. Mm. So do your squats. You'll get 40 of them in. Great for leg strength. The next time you go down, you might do some side lunges. The next time you might do your wall presses. Do you know what I mean? So
Press is what?
Is literally, if you're standing facing a wall and you're maybe like a foot away from it, and it's basically a press up off the wall. So you start with your arms outstretched, your hands are placed on the wall, and then you bend your elbow, which brings your chest closer to the wall. And it's basically like an upright press-up, but it's much easier to do. So that'll tackle the upper body. So like between wall presses and even squats and lunges, you're getting upper body and lower body. And a couple of minutes at a time is brilliant. And all of that stuff really protects against frailty. And you need to realise that, like, this loss of muscle, like that the ageing process starts in our 30s, Will. It starts in our 30s. So don't fall into the trap of, I'll think about that now when I get a bit older, because what I want for me and everyone I work with and everyone I'm in contact with is that we age with great strength, great fitness, great mobility, ability, quality of life. And that is the reality if you just get a bit more movement into your day. Not hours and hours, that's not necessary. We call them movement minutes because every minute counts. So get the legs strong, you know, get those squats in. The leg strength is the big thing for frailty. If your legs are weak, you're going to have problems with balance, coordination, movement. Like, if you think of it, Will, when you walk, every step you take, one foot's on the ground and one foot's off. So if you don't have balance, as you get older, walking and all of these daily things are going to become a problem. But they don't if you keep a little bit of leg strength work in there.
Okay, so if we think different parts of the legs, the squats, they will exercise your glutes or your arse, to put it crudely, and then if you do the lunges, is that more the front of your leg?
So the squats will do the front of the legs as well. So if you put your hand down on your thigh and give that muscle, it feels like meat, squeeze, they're your quads. They're the big muscle groups that keep us stable. So the squats will do the glutes, as you said. They'll do your quads. They'll do your calves as well, which is the back of your lower leg.
Okay, so a squat is a great all-rounder. Is there anything else you need to target that the squat won't get to?
You can do things, right, so how do I describe this in words? So you can do something, it's called a good morning exercise, right? Now, you need a little bit of balance for this one, or else you do it beside the wall. And if you think, basically, I'm standing on one leg, or actually do the easy version, stand on two legs, okay? And basically you keep your legs straight, and then what you do is you hinge at your hips. So you start to bend down, keep your back straight, bend down until you're coming as close as you can to the floor. Now, you're not going to get very far because your legs are straight. But by doing that, you'll get about halfway down and then you stand back up straight again. That gets your hamstrings. And your hamstrings are the back of the thigh, another huge muscle group. So even if it's just that, and of course, as you get stronger and better, you go from where I have 2 feet on the ground and I'm working off my 2 feet together, the harder version would be, right, now I'm on one leg, the other leg is off, I'm balancing, and now I do the very same thing, but there's a huge challenge for balance and strength, which, of course, you'll be able to do if you keep practicing.
Diane, I'm feeling some videos coming on from the Health and Fitness the show.
So we can certainly do that. You'd be absolutely amazed what you can do in 1 minute in your kitchen.
Actually, I'd be terribly disappointed, I think. But anyway, we'll take you up on that challenge. Diane, as always, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Will.
And you can hear the Health and Fitness show here on Midlands 103 Friday evenings from 7. Now, 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text, indeed, you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103. Still on the agenda today, our rights expert shall be here from 20 past 11. And one of the questions is about building houses. More specifically, building an extension to your house. And is it something that requires planning permission? If so, in what circumstances does it require planning permission? And what are the ways, perhaps, to keep it under a certain scale so that you don't have an issue with the planning department in your local council? Now, a new piece of research debunks what I think many people would think of on St. Patrick's Day, the drunken person in the corner making a mess of themselves, and this is just regarded as normal. No, it looks like it's becoming socially unacceptable to drink to excess and is seen as a big deal by 3 out of 4 adults. Now, let's hear more about this research from Porrick Walsh. She's a behavioural psychologist with Changeable.ie. Morning, Porrick.
Morning, Will.
Tell us a little bit more about these attitudes uncovered.
Yeah, so historically, Ireland's drinking culture would have been a negative stereotype, but it seems that right now there's a shift in that attitude, with the 39% of all adults and 44% of 18 to 24-year-olds agreeing that Irish drinking culture has changed for the better over the last 3 years. So the data that's emerged from this barometer is starting to suggest that things like binge drinking, things like drinking to excess, where they may have been seen as somewhat the social norm, they're certainly starting to shift away from that. And that we're seeing that there's a significant attitudinal shift that's both positive and hopeful for Ireland as we go forward.
Now, are those shifts confined to certain age groups?
It seems that there's more positivity and certainly less acceptance with younger people in that 18 to 24-year-old age group. So the data is suggesting that there's a greater agreement among them that Irish drinking culture has changed for the better over the last 3 years. So we're certainly seeing, which is promising, you know, when you're starting to look at a shift, at a kind of a generational shift, you would prefer to see that change coming from the younger generation, which is certainly promising.
Now, the policy challenge is to figure out why that's happening and to build on it.
Yeah, certainly. And also the aspect of an attitudinal change is one thing, and it's very positive. But we know that human behaviour isn't just framed by our attitudes. There are certain beliefs and values that we all have that we try to hold through, but sometimes can struggle with. And that can be the same with things like alcohol consumption, that we might have an attitude that drinking to excess or that going above the HSE guided limits is wrong. But sometimes, you know, as human beings, as social beings, we're influenced by those around us. And sometimes we find that our attitudes might tell us one thing, but our behaviour changes something completely different. And that requires additional support and additional focus. So I urge caution around an attitudinal change until we see matching behaviour change as well.
Mm. It's worth pointing out as well that even though 1 in 2 Irish adults disagree that drinking to excess is just part of culture, that also means 1 in 2 agree that drinking to excess is part of our culture. So it's quite polarising.
Yeah, it's a worrying stereotype, Will. You know, it's one that drags me down, and it drags a lot of my generation and colleagues down as well, as when you're talking to people who come over to Ireland for St. Patrick's Day, and they see that as just, and particularly the perception from abroad in places like America and the UK, is that it can just be about alcohol consumption and drinking. And we know that St. Patrick's Day is something a lot more than that. In Mullingar, you have the big festival of the half marathon that's run there, collecting for charities, for social good. In Dublin, you would have predominantly, traditionally, we would have seen the GAA, you would have seen traditional music, Irish tradition, you would have had all of the religious ceremonies around that, which was so much more. Obviously, the parades are another thing as well, which is so much more than just than alcohol consumption. And it's the perception, which is disappointing when you see people from abroad come over and say that they associate St. Patrick's Day with that. And that's their focus. It's like a one big stag, when actually there's so much more going on around that time.
And again, that will be influenced depending on your age. For somebody in their 20s, no particular attachments, certainly no kids to wake up to in the morning, then it can be that big, long stag. But somebody who's in a different life stage where they're going to have a 3-year-old jumping on their head at 8 in the morning, they're going to regard St. Patrick's Day perhaps as just another day. A little bit older again, maybe it's that chance to go hill walking. I'm talking in generalities here, obviously. But I think the age is going to very much influence the feedback that you're getting. And it's heartening, I suppose, to see that the younger group is seeing what they regard as a positive shift in attitudes among their peers, presumably.
Yeah, look, when I was looking at this data, what I said is humans were social beings. So our actions are influenced by those around us and the cultural expectations that envelop us. So if you're in a social group that is very much focused in on a festival like St. Patrick's Day, bean drinking, it's much more difficult for you to push away from that, to stand out from the norm. Whereas, you know, as we think about national drinking behaviour and the attitudes that surround it, we see that the findings from this research are highlighting that excessive drinking is becoming more and more socially acceptable. And it's seen as a big deal in 3 out of 4 adults. So within a group, you would imagine that 3 out of 4 people within that group are going to see drinking to excess as socially acceptable. So now what you have is somebody, that 1 in 4 perhaps, who is likely or potentially going to drink to excess, is going to be influenced by those other 3 who see it not as the social norm. And that's one of the things about human behaviour, is that we are influenced by those around us, by what we see, by the cultural norms that set, not just by our country or not just by our county, but by our social group. So when you were talking there about the age of people, that has a big influence. And if you're finding that younger people are seeing that excessive drinking is even more socially acceptable than previous generations, that's going to have an impact on somebody who might tip over into an excessive drinking behaviours.
Well, thank you for sharing the findings with us, Porrick. We will talk again.
Thanks very much, Will.
Porrick Walsh is a behavioural psychologist with Changeable.ie. Of course, he's originally from County Westmeath. The study published by Drink Aware, which is an organisation that tries to challenge our behaviour when it comes to drinking to excess. Interesting text from Aisling. Aisling is in her 30s and she says, in her 20s, she would often wake up after a night out with the fear. You know, the fear when you know you've done something but you can't quite put your finger on it and you're nervous for the day. So instead, what she's doing now is she will have a joint on a Friday night, sitting in, and she will laugh her way through the silliest of movies, and she doesn't have the fear the next day. Now, this is back to that debate about which is the lesser of two evils, but where do you stand on that? Regarding the 10 exercises to reverse frailty in later life, making Clonard. He has texted to say that Faulkner and Clunan should do a video to demonstrate them. Well, Clunan's on 2 walking sticks at the moment, so he's not in great shape. And at least he has the excuse of being 60. I don't, and I still probably couldn't do those exercises. Mick, challenge accepted, but it'll be a feeble attempt. Now, let's look at the weather forecast over the coming week. And the last time we spoke with Cathal Nolan from Road in County Offaly, he described the sudden atmospheric warming. Are we going to pay for this in the coming days? This is where there's a change in the upper atmosphere that can lead to cold weather down here. Cathal, good morning.
A very good morning, Will.
What's the update?
I suppose the sudden stratospheric warming event that we spoke about has occurred around about 2 weeks ago, a little bit more than that now. It takes time for those upper air, I suppose, the transition that we've seen within the upper atmosphere to transfer to the lower levels. And we're likely to see those first kind of signs, I suppose, really occurring through the early days of next week. So as we go through even Sunday into Monday, that's when we see a transition to much colder conditions, and with that, a renewed risk of some wintry precipitation at times in the Midlands.
So as I look at the temperature forecast here, the cold weather really seems to kick in around Tuesday, Wednesday night, -3, and continuing freezing for the rest of the week. For cold is one thing, it's the precipitation, it's the sleet, it's the snow that could blend in with that. What are you seeing on your projections?
Well, absolutely. In terms of temperatures, I think daytime values by the middle of next week will really struggle to get above maybe 2 to 4 degrees Celsius across parts of the Midlands. So pretty cold conditions for this time of the year. I suppose it's ironic that as we've entered into what is traditionally meteorological spring, and some are actually like the coldest conditions of the year in terms of the winter just gone by. I think in terms of precipitation, it's likely that maybe northern, northwestern areas initially could bear the brunt in terms of wintry precipitation. So certainly snow showers at this particular point in time look likely across parts of Ulster and North Connacht. For us in the Midlands, predominantly dry conditions. However, in saying that, there is certainly the risk of a dust and a snow as we go through the midweek period. As we get towards the end of the week, some weather fronts try to push up from the south and interact with the cold air, leading to the risk of maybe heavier snow in some parts. Again, it's too far out in advance to be fully sure of that, but certainly something worth keeping an eye on, because there is the potential for some disruption if that were to occur.
Now, exactly this time 5 years ago, we were all under several inches of snow, and we recall the Beast from the East and Storm Emma. And what was different then is there was the Atlantic system that interacted with that colder air coming from the east. It appears that interaction is missing this time around, thankfully.
A little premature, let's say, to say that exactly. There's those weather fronts that we spoke about towards the end of next week. So looking at the charts at the moment, there is a low-pressure system expected to push up from the south as we go into next week. The projections at the moment, let's say going by this morning's model run, again, worth emphasising, these update every 6 hours, so in saying that, it could be all changed by this afternoon, but the run this morning indicates that there is a weather front that's expected to push up, interact with the cold air, and deliver some heavier falls of snow at times. It's unlikely that it will materialise and be of a similar significance to what we saw 5 years ago. But in saying that, the risk still does exist. Let's say it's just not quite as severe, but something certainly to keep an eye on.
On a more upbeat note, reading in the Irish Independent today how climatologist Paul Moore from Met Éireann talks about El Nino and how in the second half of the year we might have warmer weather as a result of this. Now, forecasters such as yourself are always loath to go beyond 10 days in making any hard and fast predictions. So what's your take on this?
I suppose there's two strands of thought around, I suppose, forecasting, let's say. So obviously in terms of being an operation in meteorology, in terms of forecasting, let's say, and next Tuesday we can expect to see X conditions in California, let's say, for example. We can be pretty sure 7 to 10 days in advance as to what conditions are going to be, or have a very good general idea. When we start talking, I suppose, about long-term and long-range forecasting going ahead months at a time, we're looking for larger patterns at play, let's say, within the atmosphere. So when we're talking about an event such as El Nino, we're obviously talking about something which is occurring in the central Pacific across the Pacific Ocean, which then has a significant impact on global weather patterns for a series of months. So while we can't pinpoint and say, let's say, I don't know, 17th of July, for example, in or at least we'll have 31 degrees Celsius, clear blue skies, we'll say that there's a higher chance than average that given El Nino is likely to occur, that we could see warmer conditions as we go through the second half of the year, leading to potentially warmer than average warm. If that makes sense.
Yes, and we'll take that. It might not be a cast iron guarantee, but it's certainly sounding more appetising than the weather over the next few days. Cathal, as always, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Take care, Will.
Meteorologist Cathal Nolan from Road in County Offaly. You can find him online. Search for Ireland's Weather Channel on Facebook. Regarding a missing engagement ring, Kathleen once lost hers, thought she had lost it at the washing line. But she had, despite her adult children down on the hands and knees and even a metal detector out in the garden trying to find it, it wasn't until a year later when she took a lunchbox out of the press and, hey presto, the ring was sitting inside it. So her advice is, don't give up hope just yet. To Niamh, who was in the Arcadia retail park in Athlone last Saturday, filling up her car at the Apple Green, and believes the ring fell off, and she had it on her lap actually because her finger was swollen, and as she leapt out of the car, it probably went flying somewhere onto the forecourt. And if somebody finds it, she would be immensely grateful for its return. Let's cross those fingers, cross those toes, cross whatever can be crossed, that she has a similar experience to you, Kathleen. Thanks for the upbeat message. Now, still on the agenda this morning on Midlands 103, the Rights expert shall be here from 20 past 11, looking at if you're trying to apply for the Fair Deal Scheme for the first time. This is the nursing home subvention. It's quite complicated. Lots of forms involved, lots of evidence about your financial situation to gather together and compile. And, well, what's the easiest way to do this? And is there an office, a one-stop shop where you can get some support? Those questions and more answered from 20 past 11. And a little later, a decade after various Garda stations in the Midlands were closed down, some of them are reopening. So what was the point in the first place? Now, if you open up the morning newspapers, you will find examples of pensioners who have received electricity bills vastly in excess of what they had received before. For instance, in County Meath, a 100-year-old lady by the name of Kitty has received a bill for €957 for 2 months. Heretofore, her bill would have been, at its peak, £430. But it gets better. Another pensioner, Jerry Clark, 77, living in Robinstown, he this week got a bill for €1,678, again over a two-month period, nearly £1,700. And his typical bill, his, tell you what, exact bill this time last year, €290. So from a shade under £300 to €1,700. And his usage, he says, is identical. He uses oil to heat his home, so it's not heating costs. Electricity is used for lighting, for appliances, and for a water pump. So those are some individual cases. What's the big picture? The Society for St. Vincent de Paul has been looking into this, and Issy Petrie is a research and policy officer. Issy, good morning. Tell us what your findings have uncovered.
So thanks very much for having me on to talk about this. And yeah, so we're talking really about people who are starting to see those winter bills coming through the door and are maybe getting a shock at the size of those bills compared to last year or compared to kind of even earlier in the year. So at St. Vincent de Paul, our calls where people were kind of requesting help with their energy costs, who were having real trouble with their energy costs, went up by 40% last year in 2022. And we know from CSO data nationally across Ireland that the amount of people who actually couldn't keep their home warm enough last year doubled. So that's a lot of people that are kind of already really being affected by these high prices that we're seeing at the moment.
Can you put a number on that? How many people were unable to heat their homes adequately?
So in 2022, that had reached 375,000 people. So that was sort of from the first half of last year, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
So it could be that number's gone up since then as prices have kind of continued to go up.
So this was doubling over the 2021 period. Does your study take into account the measures given back by government, the likes of these energy credits, to try and limit the effect of the increases?
So, you know, we've obviously seen new measures were announced in recent weeks, but in terms of the measures that were announced later last year, kind of measures that were announced in Budget 2023 and started to come in over, you know, recent months around the Christmas period, it would have looked at those. And I would say that we did really welcome those targeted payments that came in over the winter months that was supporting people who we knew were going to struggle the most really with energy costs. And those targeted payments did make a really big difference, but we don't think they necessarily did, you know, sorted the whole problem out. As you said there, people are still facing bills they really can't afford, and so there are definitely still measures that we need to keep putting in place. And you know, we would have liked to have seen in the budget things like making sure core social welfare rates keep up with inflation. So while they were welcome, and there's still more to be done.
Well, one of the criticisms of the energy credit from some in politics and indeed in economics is that it was universal, it was untargeted. So if you were a multimillionaire, you received the €200 credit. If you were on social welfare, you received the €200 credit. Is there a different approach you would advocate?
Yeah, and so there were additional targeted payments, and those are that targeting is what we would have liked to see more of, really. The universal payments obviously also reached lots of people who needed help, so they also made a difference. But we don't think it was necessarily the best way of spending those funds. And really, we would have liked to see more focus on those targeted payments.
Sometimes the targeting itself can be an expensive exercise. What might have been the most streamlined and efficient way to get the money to the right people?
So we, you know, through the social welfare system, you know, through things like whether that's the pension, the state pension, or through payments like the fuel allowance, we already have a system in place that targets people that we know might need the most assistance. So really, we would see things like, you know, additional money through the fuel allowance, making sure the fuel allowance is reaching everybody that needs it. Those are sort of some of the really important measures we'd like to see.
Your research draws on Central Statistics Office data. So have we been here before, for instance, in the financial crash of 2008 or any crisis since, where so many people have struggled to heat their homes?
Yeah, and SDP would have been supporting people during that time too, and definitely at that time, energy poverty and people needing help with energy assistance was at that point a really big focus for the society. And we saw, you know, lots of people experiencing deprivation, which would have been in the statistics you're talking about there again at that point. And, you know, we're seeing those numbers rising again now through this period.
All right, we will watch and wait to see what the policy response is. Thank you very much for your time. Izzy Petrie is a research and policy officer with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. The average electricity bill, €1,000 in the spring of 2020, now doubled to €2,100. And there are outliers, as I mentioned earlier. Kitty, 100 years of age, in Meath, at nearly €1,000 for a two-month period. And then Jerry, who's 77, €1,700 for a two-month period, with no particular rhyme or reason. He hasn't any extra consumption that he can point to. It was £290 last year. Why such a huge difference? It doesn't just add up in unit rate. There's more going on, he thinks. What's your say? What's been your bill? And have you dared to even open the envelope yet? 083 30 10 103. Text or WhatsApp, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. It's time to say hello to Tom Walsh from the Tullamore Citizens Information Centre. He is your rights expert. Brain to be picked for the next 20 minutes. How are you?
I'm very good now. I don't know about the brain, but sure, we'll do our best.
Well, you're caffeined up and you've a bottle of water in front of you. Good hydration. Here we go. Paula is first to ask a question. Paula is in Mullingar and asking about the support package announced recently by government and who is going to reap the benefit of it. Right. Where do you start?
Well, actually, it's quite a long list here I have in front of me, but we'll go through it anyway. So there's a wide selection of public will receive support from this package. That's just it's broad range, I suppose. If we start in April 2023, a once-off payment of €200 will be paid to anyone getting a working family payment or a weekly social welfare payment that qualifies for a Christmas bonus. So in other words, if you've got a Christmas bonus, you're going to get this as well. You can only get one 200 payment even if you get more than one qualifying payment. So some people would be on, we say, like the state pension, and they'd be also on, we say, carers allowance half rate. But they'll only get it the once. Mm. In June then of 23, we're going to get an extra €100 for each child that will be paid with the child benefit. And there will be no leaving certificate or junior cycle examination fees this year. But the rechecking of the was coming back in this year, the €40 for rechecking the results, that's coming back in. So there's no charges for the actual exams, but if you want to get them rechecked, there will be a charge. The fee for school transport scheme in 23-24 will be reduced to €50 per primary school child and €75 per secondary school child, and a cap of €125 for a family. So I think it was free this year and they're bringing it back, or free last year and they're bringing it back in, but it's
phasing.
Reduced.
Mm.
Yeah. The reduction in VAT will remain at 9% until the 31st of August 2023 for the hospitality service and until the 31st of October 2023 for gas and electricity. So some way of following on from what you were saying about the gas and electricity, at least there'll be some relief a little bit. Public service obligation refund for electricity customers. All domestic electricity customers will get a refund of €89.10 on their electricity bills. Now, the catch is the refund will be paid in seven instalments of €12.73 from the 1st of March 2023. Don't ask me why they've decided to do it that way, but that's the way it's been done. So it's been spread over a number of months. And the moratorium on gas and electricity disconnections for domestic customers has been extended up to the 31st of March 2023, bringing it in line with the moratorium for vulnerable customers. And the eviction ban is in place on the 30th of October 2022, from 2022 to the 31st of March 2023. This means that if you are renting private accommodation, you cannot be evicted during these months, even if you've been issued. So a lot of landlords would be issued already. Now, there's a lot of talk about that might change, but at the moment it hasn't. So just to be aware of that, whatever you hear on the radio might not be, this is the actual fact. It still hasn't been changed. So they're really the changes that are coming about.
Well, hopefully, Paula, some of those will apply to you. Next is Kim in Athlone, who has rented out one of the bedrooms in her home to a student. She never gave them a written contract because they were a friend of a friend type situation. But they are a living nightmare to live with, she says. The house is in a mess and there are midweek parties, which keeps her six-year-old awake at night. So she wants rid of them, but she's wondering, does she have to give them notice? What's the procedure?
Can I give her a simple answer? Yes, get rid of them. They do not fall under the Tenancy Act. So she didn't need to give them a contract or a for that. Mm. So, no.
Because this is a rent-a-room situation.
It's a rent-a-room scheme. And remember, it's her home. She's inviting people into her home. So she has that idea to block anybody coming in. So whether she wants to get rid of this person who's staying there, or she can just stop people coming in for their parties. She can just say, look, this is my house. I don't care if he's renting a room. It's still my house. Mm. So, yeah, simple answer is she can get rid of him or his and stop the parties.
See you later. Next is Niamh, who paid her motor tax online but still hasn't received her tax disc. She has emailed the department and hasn't received a reply. It is now 1 month out of date, her old disc, so she's worried she will be stopped by the Gordie.
Yeah, when she did it online, she would have received a confirmation email. So what I would advise her to do is print that off, bring it into the local tax office, motor tax office, and they'll sort it out for her there and then. Mm. Once she has the proof that she actually paid it.
Carry it with her in the car in the meantime anyway.
Exactly.
Evidence that you have paid. Hannah is in Mount Melick and is getting married. Congratulations. She intends to take her husband's name. So she's wondering, how does she change all of her documents?
Simply because the marriage certificate is going to be the legal document which is changing her name. So after that, if she wants to change on her bank accounts or anything like that, or any of the public bodies, she just writes them a letter stating that from such and such a date, I now want to be called Mary Jane Walsh or whatever it is, you know. So she's just, once she has the legal document, she doesn't need to do anything else legally.
Liam is in for ban. Liam has lost his driving licence and subsequently applied for a new one, but has since found the old one. So he's wondering, can he use both or should he destroy the original?
Well, first of all, he can't use both because one will have a block on it. And if he presents that at a checkpoint and they run it through their system, it's going to come up as...
He's in trouble.
He would be. So don't destroy it either. What he needs to do is contact the driving licence section and return it to them, the NDLS, National Driving Licence Section.
He doesn't get a refund, does he?
No. But you see, the new one is going to be the one that's going to have the... like a bank card, you know, that type of thing. The old one is gone. There's a block on it.
Geraldine in Burr says she is living alone, is 65 years of age, and is wondering if she is entitled to fuel allowance.
Yeah, now, when I got this, because the way we got it was that full allowance, and I was wondering, what's a full allowance? So,
oh, actually, yes, there is a typo in there. Yeah, is it full allowance full or fuel allowance?
Yeah, yeah, full allowance. And we were looking at it, and I, like you, was thinking to myself, maybe she means the fuel allowance. It's hard to know because she's just saying, I'm living alone and 65. You know, I don't know her income. It is a means-tested payment. My advice to people always is apply for something. If you get a refusal back, you can then argue the point, well, that's not really true. I don't have that income or whatever it is. So my advice would be to apply for it. That's my advice. Now, if it wasn't a typo and it's the full, she's not sure, I'm not sure what she's looking for.
Mm.
But I think it is fuel allowance. I think it's just a typo.
Nicola is in Tullamore. She moved to the Midlands from the north to be with her boyfriend. And she's not in work at the moment, so she's wondering, would she be able to apply for job seekers benefit or allowance? She never worked in the Republic prior to this.
First thing she'll have to do is get a PPS number. No matter what else, everything else comes from that. So if she gets a PPS number, then what she does is she applies for it. What's going to happen is the job seekers, because it's a means-tested payment, they're going to take in the family income. So it's going to be her and her partner's income that's going to be taken into account. But she needs to get the PPS number first.
Rosie is in Edenderry and she wants to apply for the Fair Deal Scheme. This is the Nursing Home Subvention Scheme. And she's wondering, what does she need to do it?
Right. Sorry.
You have a long list, I bet.
Yeah, no, actually, it's not that. I thought it might be, but it's not. No. There are two issue assessments taken into account when a person is applying for the Fair Deal Nursing Home Scheme, a medical and a financial assessment. So you must be ordinary resident in Ireland and need a long-term nursing home care to apply for the scheme. You need to be approved for Fair Deal before you can receive funding from a nursing home. You can download an application form or they're available from any healthcare centre. So what you need to do is get the document, read through it, fill it in and then submit it. I can't say whether somebody will be granted it or not, but because it depends on their application and what their means are and all the stuff that goes with it. But like I keep saying, if you don't apply, you won't know.
And remember, if you have qualified, you can apply for a review of your financial circumstances after 12 months.
That's it. So don't be put off initially. That's what I keep saying to people. When they apply for something, they might get put off because they get a Dear John letter back saying, no, you don't. But it's when you get that letter, you can see what the grounds were that they said you can't. And then you can go back and say, well, that's actually not the real case, because the real case is such and such a thing.
Credit where it's due, and I know different offices in different parts of the country might have different cultures, but I've dealt with the crew on Bury Quay in Tullamore in the nursing homes office, and they're fantastic and they're very helpful. And anyway, credit where it's due.
They're actually the national office.
Are they?
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, a few people are giving out about motor tax. Why, for instance, we pay for 3 months €233, but 790 for a full year. It's not an even quarter. Why are they trying to make more money off those who pay for 3 months instead of 12? And another caller tells us there was a glitch recently with paying motor tax online. Happened for a couple of days last month. So if that lady didn't get email confirmation, it's possible her transaction didn't go through. So she needs to check her bank account, see if the payment was deducted. But either way, per Tom's advice, contact the motor section of your local county council. In a few minutes' time, the Gartha stations that a decade ago were closed but are now reopening. What's the thinking here? First, though, Tom Walsh is with us from the Tullamore Citizens Information Service, and the next question comes from Eddie in Port, and he is considering a small extension to the rear of the house so that he would have a downstairs toilet and shower. Does he need planning permission?
Well, can I say the most common reasons for needing planning permission, if you want to, is you build an extension which is more than 40 square metres. This includes any new or existing extensions. So once it's below that, you don't need the planning permission. So what they're saying is you have the square metres of your house, And if you add more than 40 square metres to that, you're going to need planning permission. Now, also,
so that's what, about 5 by 8 metres?
Yeah.
But in different configurations. Yeah. But yeah, so it's not big.
No. It's be bigger than this room. It would be.
Yeah, only you can see the room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, yeah. So, sorry, forget I'm on radio. Yeah, yeah. It's a fair size. 40 square meters doesn't sound much, but it actually is a fair size when you're building an extension. And he's talking about just building a downstairs toilet and shower. Hmm. So that would be actually quite small. So he can go, you know, but for the general sort of thing, people have got to take into account not just that, but they've also got to take into account the height of the building. So if you're in a single-storey house and you're going to build something that's going to go above the level of the existing house, you need planning permission. Mm. You'll have to take into account if there's going to be windows. Are there going to be overlooking other properties? Is it going to cause a privacy issue? There are smaller things to take into account, not a huge amount. Mm.
Does the aspect matter? He says to the rear of the house, would it be different if it were at the front?
Of course it would, yes, because it would change the whole character of the house. You would definitely need a planning permission there, because generally with the planning permission that's granted to the builders of the house is that it uniformity and it, you know, whatever it is. My advice to him in this situation would be to contact the planning department in his local authority. If he rings them up and just says to them, look, here's what I'm planning to do, they are generally very good at giving advice like that.
He's in Port Arlington. Does he ring Leash or does he ring Offaly?
Well, which side of the river is he on?
Exactly, yeah. Olivia says, friends of hers who are originally from Ukraine have been living in Spain since they fled their home country. Now, they intend to come here and move in with her, and she is wondering what paperwork they will need before travelling to Ireland.
Well, what they need to do is they need to have some form of identification. The Irish government has accepted that not everybody fleeing a war zone would have full documentation. So they might not have passports, or the passport might be out of date when they had to leave. So the Irish government and the European Union has accepted. So they would accept identity cards, passports that are out of date, things like that. That would be. So when they apply, when they arrive in Ireland, now they have an arrangement with all the airline companies to accept those documentations. So because a lot of people, if you're travelling out of the country, you need to have a valid passport when you get to the airline check-in desk. So they've arranged that with the airline companies. When they arrive in Dublin, then they need to go and see the immigration officer, and then they will take it from there. If they're looking for to be housed or something like that, they'll probably be sent to the City West Reception Centre. But if they already have accommodation sussed, but they just need to let the government, you know, the Immigration Office, know that they've arrived and here's the situation.
Final one. Betty is living in a housing estate and is complaining of littering. She says there are no public bins, so she's not necessarily blaming the residents. She's wondering, should the council be obliged to provide bins?
Well, that's a tricky one now. That'll be one for the councillors, because the local authorities must arrange for collection, disposal and recovery of household waste and litter generally. My advice would be, again, to contact the local authority and see what it is, because if it's a housing estate that has been taken in charge, we say like if it's a public housing estate that's already owned by the county council, if it's a private housing estate that has been taken in charge by the council, then they have an obligation to maintain it to a certain degree. I know the one thing that they will not do, definitely not do, in public house or private housing estates that have been taken over, they won't cut the grass. But they are obliged to maintain the litter in the area.
Mm.
What happens a lot of times is residents' association themselves, or I've done it myself on our own estate, go out and pick up the litter, because some people are just messy.
Yes, but if you get a bin, then the question is who's going to empty it?
And where does
it go?
But also with bins, what they've found is, and the council will tell you this, what happens is people begin to then put the household rubbish into it and it fills up overnight.
Mm.
So that's the problem with putting in bins, because I've seen it happen where people...
Oh, if only life's problems were simple. But for those that can be answered, you can ring Tom or his colleagues in the Tullamore Citizens Information Centre, or indeed their friends in the various centres around the Midlands.
Can I just ask you, or take this opportunity, just to give a shout out, please. We are recruiting volunteers for the service in Laois and Offaly. If people are interested in offering the service, then what we require is somebody who would be willing to give one day a week. Full training is provided in the service. I'm a volunteer in the service. I didn't have the experience before I went in, so the full training is provided in the service. If they are interested, if they contact the Tullamore office of the Citizens Information Service, because Tullamore office is Tullamore and Portlaoise, or Tullamore
right.
and Laois.
Coordinates them.
Yes.
And you don't need a background in social welfare,
no,
taxation.
I had no, I was in, worked in industry all my life, and I did a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of the other, but no, I was never a...
You were doing Nixers. Are they allowed?
No. Well, not so much Nixers. Not like Del Boy now or anything like that, but...
Tom, always enjoy having
Thank
you on the programme. Thank you very much. Tom Walsh from the Tullamore Citizens Information Centre. Oh boy, Aisling has put the cat among the pigeons, suggesting that you are better off sitting in on a Friday night smoking a joint than going out and having a few too many drinks. Jimmy in Port says, I really don't see what's wrong with going to the pub, drinking 10 pints of Guinness over a 3 or 4 hour period and going home without causing any problems. It's the younger generation of men and women who don't actually know how to drink properly. They down lots of vodkas and Red Bulls after another in a very short period of time. That is not proper drinking, he says. A different caller, Willie, also in Port, says the lady is being irresponsible. Excuse me, that's not really important. The lady is being irresponsible. She knows she is funding crime, and maybe it's time she starts thinking about her behaviour. That's because cannabis is illegal. The text from Willie in Port was about the woman who lost her engagement ring, Niamh from Galway, passing through Athlone at the weekend, losing it at a filling station in the Arcadia area. He suggests she prays and sends a few bob to St. Anthony's box. I always find a missing item after praying to St. Anthony. And Will, just in from picking up rubbish, says Breed, and in the side of the road between my house and the next, which is about 30 feet, I collected a full black bag of mainly Coke cans, Supermax papers, burger wrappers, just on one small stretch of road in the countryside. So please, if anybody is listening and you have a munch at the weekend, bin the bags and bin the cans and don't have somebody else cleaning up after you. If you cast your mind back a decade ago, you may remember several Gartha stations in rural parts of the Midlands were closed, and some of them, the buildings, were since sold on. But two of those stations are going to reopen, albeit with limited opening hours. Robert McDermott is a Fianna Fáil member of Offaly County Council. Robert, good morning.
Morning, Will.
So, which stations are reopening and for how long?
Road and Angan are the initial ones they're looking at reopening, and they will have limiting opening hours. So they will. And they'll be mainly for people if they want to get passports and such signed up. But at the moment, the residents have to come to Eatonderry. And even there, regard the station, a lot of pressure. We could do with a few more numbers in there. So sometimes might come into town and the station is closed due to no fault of the local Gardaí because they're under pressure. So this would actually be a good community service to have initially to get it open back in those villages and towns. Yeah.
So is this an operational decision by the Gardaí or is it a political decision? Who made the call?
It's a lot of moving parts in these decisions. Well, there would have been a lot of political pressure in the background, but ultimately it was a Garda call. You know, so, yeah, they see the need for it. And it's good to get back out in the community. And it gives people a lot of confidence when the local station is open.
What condition are the buildings in?
I believe they're okay. It wouldn't take a whole lot to get them reopened. And they're in good nick. But I think the station in your own town of Clumbalode needs a good bit of repair before that could be looked at. But the other two are... They open up quick enough.
And we're a very law-abiding type in Clumbalogue anyway. Don't need a guard station.
That's true, Will.
Although it went downhill a bit in the last few years. Some fella from Kildare moved in.
Yeah, so I heard.
There were 43 different barracks put up for sale some years ago, and some in the Midlands sold for less than €20,000. They were turned into tourist centres, ambulance bases, offices of the state pathologist, various purposes all over the years. For instance, Ballacolligar, the station in Laois, sold for just €15,000. Rathowen in Westmeath also selling for €15,000. Do you know if Danganor Road were on the cusp of being sold at some point?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so, Will. Never heard of it, but I wasn't as active as I was now as I was. I never came across that being a door for sale.
Unfortunately, I think the moral of the story is this development won't be everywhere. It's fortunate that Dangan and Road had the buildings physically still available.
Correct. And there is a kind of, as you know yourself, the in the north obviously as well, so that would be a help.
And is there a timetable for this to happen?
No, it hasn't been put in writing yet, timetable, but there is a will to make it happen, and make it happen as soon as possible. That's the word I'm getting on it. So hopefully, as soon as possible. The first thing, I suppose, is to get it announced is going to happen, and I would just keep the pressure on to make it happen as soon as possible. But there is a will to do it, which is good.
Is it in any way influenced by the local elections next year?
Don't believe so. No, this has been going on a while. Well, it'd be definitely a help, all right, for the local elections. But no, this has been going on a talk about for a while, and it'd be good to get the numbers increased in Eton Derry as well. And there is a good card recouping on nationwide. So hopefully, North Offaly will get a few more of those guards.
Well, we'll watch that space. I'm sure there will be similar campaigns fueled elsewhere, because there are many villages sore about the loss of their Garda station, and when they see two in North Offaly being reopened, it may well fuel campaigns elsewhere. Robert McDermott, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Will.
He is a Fianna Fáil member of Offaly County Council. Yeah, there were 43 different Garda stations that were sold in 2014. And in total, the state raised €3.2 million. A lot of money to you and me, but not a king's ransom in the grand scheme of what the state deals with day to day. And in the Midlands, 6 Garda stations were sold. Giessle secured €123,000. Ballinakil in Laois, €92,000. But as I mentioned, some of the others for just a princely sum of €15,000, Rathowen and Ballacolla, and the opportunity now gone in those areas to reopen the stations, even in a limited way, which is, I think many in those villages will agree, a great pity. After the news at 11, we were talking about the increase in electricity bills and how the average family has more than doubled in their payout for electricity over the spring period this year compared to last year. And there are many examples of more than doubling, a tripling or even quadrupling of bills from listeners in different parts of the Midlands, and they cannot make rhyme or reason of why. Their usage has not increased at all, and even the unit prices don't seem to explain the full difference. And there was that pensioner in County Meath. At an extreme example, I'll grant you, €290 was his bill this time last year, and now it is in excess of €1,600. So that's very hard to explain, more than quadrupling. Now, if the sums don't add up, challenge your electricity company. Make sure you add up the unit cost yourself. Look at the standing charges. Standing charges are a sneaky way. Even if you have solar panels on your roof and you're no longer taking from the grid, you still have to pay the standing charge. But scrutinise those bills, make sure that every single euro and cent is accounted for, and we will come back to that issue tomorrow. Thank you very much, Sinead and Chloe, for putting it all together. Thank you for listening. Carl James is coming next with the afternoon show. Have a great Thursday. Have a great Thursday. Bye-bye.